Thank you for listening to the Missio Dei Uptown podcast. We are a church committed to our neighborhood, seeking to love and serve our beautifully unique community as we join God as He makes all things new. To learn more about us, visit mduptown.com.
I'm going to go ahead and transition to In My Time by asking if anyone here has seen, or at least seen parts of, the movie Mickey 17. Has anyone seen Mickey 17? All right, thank you, three of you. Now, I have only seen half because that's, I'm like how a lot of people read. I watch movies. I like watch half, and then I'm like, I don't have time. I'll finish it later, and then we just never finish it and start a new movie. But Mickey 17, the idea was really, really appealing to me. And so what it is essentially it's a sci-fi dark humor with Robert Pattinson. And he is, I don't want to spoil anything, but he is essentially on this spaceship where he's been invited, and his role is to basically do these experiments and do these things that will almost always get him killed. And if it doesn't, then they will just throw him into the next one, which will certainly get him killed. And the whole idea of Mickey 17 is that they actually have this like cloning technology where he keeps all of his same like memories and all of that. And so they just keep sending Mickey over and over and over to be killed. And so we essentially enter the story on the 17th iteration of Mickey. And so I loved this idea, and I loved at least the first half of the movie, because what it explores is sort of the internal life of the character Mickey and essentially how he dreads being killed every single time, even though he knows he's going to come back. It's this really interesting picture of wrestling with death, even if it is not the end of his story. And it got me thinking, it is a really like strange idea, right? But what if this was our invitation every single day? What if our invitation was our choosing to die in a way every single day, dying to ourselves as a choice? And what if it were even possible? And what if we were even invited into having joy over that process? It is a wild idea to be like, I'm going to actually choose death in my life every single day, and I'm going to celebrate it. And yet, it is a Bible that it is an idea that the Bible hits on over and over and over, this idea of dying to self and enjoying it when it happens. And I know some of you are just like, okay, I'm out. Like, this is too weird, this is too much, but we're gonna get there, okay? If you have not been with us, we have been in a series in the book of Colossians. And last week, Dr. Sophia Magallanes Seng from North Park took us through an academic dive into part of the beginning of Colossians chapter 2. But I gave her an option to do a couple of passages, so we skipped a passage, which is the passage we're going to get into today and the passage that Jake read for us. And so what I want to do is I'm going to read the section, part of the section that we read 2 weeks ago, that I preached on 2 weeks ago, in order to give us sort of the context of where we are going to be today. And so let me read for you Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 20. And if you were here, I think it'll come back pretty quickly. Starting verse 15. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through Jesus and for Jesus. He, Jesus, is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all of God's fullness dwell in Jesus, and through Jesus to reconcile to God all things, whether things on earth or in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on a cross. And so 2 weeks ago, this is the context of where we're going today. 2 weeks ago, we talked about this picture of Jesus. And it was a picture of Jesus as the image of God, supreme over creation, where everything was created in him, through him, and for him. And not only that, it was a picture of Jesus continuing to sustain it all. A picture of Jesus providing sustenance to the entire church. He is the head of the church. A picture of Jesus being the firstborn from the dead. A picture of God being pleased to have his fullness dwell in Jesus and to reconcile all things to himself through Jesus. And I think the takeaway here is that this was a supremely powerful view of Jesus, right? This is an enormous picture of who Jesus is. So that's what we talked about 2 weeks ago. But then I want to bring you into, and what Paul does is he brings us into his story. Because then we have Paul, the apostle of Jesus. He is a messenger of Jesus or an ambassador of Jesus. And where is Paul when he is writing this massive view of Jesus? When he's writing Colossians, where is Paul sitting? Yeah, I'm going to tell you, it's not at a desk, right? It's in prison. Look at Colossians 4, chapter 3. And pray for us too, that God may open a door for our message so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ, for which I am in chains. For which I am in chains. Sorry, random picture. Can someone turn on that back TV? I was like, oh, we don't have slides, and then they're actually working. It's just the TV. So Paul is in prison, right? Which I'm sure many of you have heard before. Some of you even just said it, that Paul was in prison at times. But I want you to think about this idea, the fact that Paul is in prison, and he just talked about the power of Jesus. See, if an important messenger of a king or a president is in prison in another country or a kingdom, there is an effort of that king or that president to get that messenger free, right? We hear all the time about like people who are kept. I think Brittany Griner, the WNBA player a few years ago, was kept in prison in Russia, and there was, albeit half-hearted, there was an effort to get her back by our administration, right? When there's maybe an important messenger, that effort is even wretched up like tenfold, right? Now, what if it's a powerful king or president? Not only do they provide this effort, but they very often are successful in getting this messenger or this ambassador out of prison, right? But now think about this. What if that king was the king of the universe? What if that king was the one by whom, through whom, and for whom everything was created? What if that king was the one who holds the breath of every living creature in his hand? Don't you think he could free his messenger at the snap of a finger? And yet, we have this dissonant picture of Paul, the messenger of Jesus in prison, and Jesus, the powerful king, essentially not snapping his finger to release Paul. And I don't know if we've thought about this picture like this, right? But, or even the fact that like tons of bad stuff, and we're going to read some of it later, but tons of bad stuff happen to Paul. And then I think what happens and what Paul often is addressing in his writing is that this brings into question the power of God, right? The people that Paul are writing to have often voiced concerns, or at least have heard concerns from other apostles or other messengers, that God must not be really powerful, or Paul must not be really with God if he is in prison and he's saying all these things about Jesus, right? And I think this is a fair question. I think very often our question would be like, why is there evil in the world if God is good and powerful, right? It's a question that we ask ourselves a lot, or that we are asked a lot. And while Paul doesn't take time to completely unpack the reality of evil in our world, and we won't have time to really dive into the question or the problem of suffering in our world, he does begin to explore the reality of why Christians still suffer on this side of eternity. He explores that your life, at least in a material sense, is not promised to get better on this side of eternity if you follow Jesus, right? That's what we would call the prosperity gospel. And it is a false gospel. And we should know that our side or our life on this side of eternity, if we start to follow Jesus, is not promised to get, let me be clear, materially better. Even if certain people might try to discredit Christianity because of that, right? Oh, well, your God must not be powerful if your life is not that hard. Or if your life is hard, right? Your God must not be good if you got a car accident and then got a nail in your tire and then your dog, you know? Right? That if God was so powerful, you wouldn't suffer. And Paul would know that people would be saying this. And he would know that they would at least be like thinking about this amongst themselves. Can we trust Paul if so much bad stuff is happening to him, right? Which is why Paul follows up this grand picture of the power of Jesus with an anticipatory explanation of his chains. And that's where we find ourselves today. Before the Colossians could even write back, he writes in verse 24, "Now I rejoice in what I am suffering for you." I rejoice in what I am suffering for you. That is a wild thing to say, right? This guy is in prison, and it's not like our kind of prison, right? It's like a first, and I'm not saying prison is great here, but like, this is a first century prison, which sounds bad, you know, just like, I don't even really know what it was like, but it sounds a lot worse than maybe what we even picture. First century prison, and he is saying that he rejoices in the suffering that he is experiencing. And let me say, this is not a one-time thing that Paul says. It's not like we caught him in a good moment where he's just like, caught a little bit of sun through his potential window, right? I don't know if he had windows or not, let's be real. The reality is this is something that Paul says over and over and over, and the Bible explores over and over and over. And so I'm going to show you a few places that reveal to you some of how Paul reacts about or calls us into reacting to suffering. And I'm going to kind of blow through these right now just because of time. And so if you're wanting to sort of explore the theology of suffering, I would say write these down. Take a picture. So I'm just going to read sort of like out of context a couple of things. So Romans 5:3, he says, "Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope." Or 1 Peter 4:12, "Dear friends, do not be," this is actually Peter writing, sorry, this is not Paul, but "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that has come onto you to test you, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But rejoice in as much as you participate in the sufferings of Christ." Again, a wild statement. 2 Corinthians 11, here's the sort of resume of Paul's sufferings. "You thought I had a hard week. Listen to this. I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently," he's actually responding to me directly, "been in prison more frequently," in case you didn't know, that was a joke, okay, "been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, and been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was pelted with stones." Sounds terrible. 3 I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false believers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? But here it is. If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness." In other words, that's a lot of crap and I'm going to brag about it, right? Or how about another non-Paul one? James 1:2. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, when you face trials of many kind. Or, okay, I know I'm beating a dead horse, but one more beat. Acts 5:41. The apostles left the Sanhedrin. They were just persecuted for their faith, rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. Day after day, in the temple of courts and from house to house, they never stopped teaching and proclaiming the good news that Jesus is the Messiah. Right? In case you were wondering, this is a big theme, particular in the New Testament, that often Christians will experience suffering, and we are called to rejoice in that suffering. And again, I think just like objectively, or if we were to stand outside, like some of us who maybe grew up Christian or have been in the Christian subculture for a long time have heard a lot of this language. But if you step outside for just a second, it's like, you're nuts. if I was just like so pumped about this week, right? But the reality is that Paul is rejoicing for his suffering. And so today, what I want to do is I want to explore just verse 24. I was going to preach through chapter 2, verse 5, but I was like, we're going to come back next week and hit on another idea in this section because this is too rich in order for us to move on. And so we are literally just going to look at verse 24 in the rest of my time today in order to see why is Paul saying that he is rejoicing in his suffering. So let's read the rest of verse 24. It says, "Now I rejoice in what I am suffering for you, and I fill up in my flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's affliction for the sake of his body, which is the church." Okay, this is confusing, and then when you sort of untangle it, it actually feels heretical. So we're going to spend a little bit of time on this. Let's focus on the phrase first, fill up in my flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's affliction. Because I think basically if you take some time with it, what it sounds like he is saying is that Paul, by suffering in prison, is bringing to completion what Jesus began. In other words, it sort of sounds like Paul, like Jesus, is suffering, and he is completing some of the same work that Jesus did in his suffering on the cross. And so the question becomes, is Paul saying that he is some sort of savior, that his suffering is also redemptive for humanity? And the answer is no, as you probably anticipated. This is not what Paul is saying. See, Jesus did not say it has begun on the cross, right? I don't know why I said begun like that, but we're going to keep going. Jesus said it is finished, right? In Hebrews 10:10, it tells us that we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all, right? And so this action only took one time. And so Paul's not saying, I am suffering to bring the redemptive work of Jesus to completion. That is already done. Paul knows it is already done. So what is Paul saying here? All he is revealing is that he was the messenger to the Colossians. That the completion that needed to happen was not completing the redeeming work of Jesus, but it was completing the bringing of the message to those in Colossae. Think about it like this. In the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, Abraham Lincoln signed a bill, that brought an end to chattel-based slavery in America. But those who were enslaved throughout America, African-American folks who were enslaved, were not all released on that same day that he signed that letter, right? They were not all released on January 1st, 1863, because not everyone hears the news that day. It wasn't until June 19th, what we refer to as Juneteenth, 1865, where Union Major General Gordon Granger brought to completion the work that Lincoln did by arriving in Galveston, Texas, where the last enslaved folks in America were, and he issued General Order Number 3, which announced that all enslaved people were free. And so in this example, and bear with me, I know this is, some of you are going to be like, that's not fully true, it's just a metaphor, right? In this example, Lincoln did the work, Granger brought the news, right? And again, all metaphors break down because we know Lincoln did not do the work on his own, right? And the reality is Lincoln is not Jesus. But Paul was bringing Jesus' work to completion through his suffering in the same way, because it was his suffering, because of his suffering, that more people heard about the news of Jesus. More people like the Colossians were being told about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus because of what Paul was doing. In other words, Jesus did the work and Paul brought the news. And so that's what he's saying when he says in verse 24 that I am rejoicing in the suffering because I am filling up in the flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's affliction. Again, it's not lacking in the redemptive work. It was lacking in the Colossians hearing about the redemptive work. Everyone with me? Good, good, good. And Paul is finding joy in this. He is finding joy in this because he is getting to imitate the way of Jesus. And this, in this imitation, he's finding joy because more and more people are experiencing the risen Christ that is found in and modeled through Paul's life. Paul says it this way in 2 Corinthians 4. He says, starting in verse 10, we always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. AKA, we're suffering just like Jesus did, so that others may know about Jesus, right? Let me keep going. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may also be revealed in our mortal body. So then death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. I love this idea. That when we model our lives after Jesus by dying to ourselves, right? Paul is not talking about like literally physically dying here. He's talking about laying down his rights, laying down his life so that others may get to hear the news. And so that when we model our lives after Jesus by dying to ourselves, we also get to participate in presenting the beauty of Jesus to them. See, New Testament scholar Michael Gorman coined this term that I found really fun and really helpful. He calls it cruciformity. Cruciformity. It's just a combination of words, right? It's conformity to the crucifix. And he explains it like this. He says, it is the ministry of the living Christ who reshapes all relationships and responsibilities to express the self-giving, life-giving love of God that was displayed on the cross. In other words, the cross was and is a destabilizing force against the value system of the world that says I ought to only think about myself, care about myself, look out for myself. Right? The cross flies in the face of this value system. And it provides a framework for a new mode of living. Namely, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. And I think this idea of like death might feel a bit extreme to some of you to explain it like this. But Paul shows us in Colossians and other places that this is just a reality of living out who we have already been made to be. Right? He says it this way in Colossians 3, which we'll get to and preach on again later in this series. He says, Colossians 3:3, for you died, and your life is hidden now with Christ in God. Or consider his words in Galatians 2, where he says it very straightforward. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Our old self is dead, and we are now alive in Jesus. Another way to say it, that Paul says it, Jesus is our life. Jesus is our life. We are not trying to live for Jesus. I think that that's common wording, and that's totally okay. But I think when you recognize that actually Jesus is just our life, it's actually a lot more freeing, right? It's not like I am like straining in my own power to try to live a life that's worthy to God. God has already been made already made us worthy, and Jesus is our life, and we just live out of that life, out of that power. And so we are invited into the self-giving, life-giving love of God that was displayed on the cross. And I'm going to be honest, like, I have always been captivated by this idea of being given over to death, as Paul says it. I'm captivated by what it looks like to take joy in our sufferings for the sake of others. But I still don't think we, like, completely understand what Paul is inviting us into. And so John Stott, not Trott, talks about it this way. He says, it may be, when talking about this idea, it may be a death to comfort and ease, and a separation from home and relatives, or a death to personal ambition, as they, being Christians, renounce the temptation to climb the professional ladder, being content to remain in a humble servant ministry instead, or a death to cultural imperialism. In these and other ways, we may be called to die as the means to a life of fruitfulness. You see, what Stott is getting at is that I'm afraid we think of this idea of, like, dying for ourselves or dying for our faith or, like, laying down our lives for others as these just, like, enormous moments and only the enormous moments. Because I think they can be big moments, but I used to always think of it as, like, well, if someone's in the street, if a child is in the street and there's a bus coming, I'm going to push them out of the way and get hit by the bus myself. You know what I mean? And I would have had plenty of time to get out of the way of the van. I know people used to always ask me in college, if someone held a gun to your head and was like, do you believe in Jesus? What would you say? And I was like, I'd say yes, right? But then I wouldn't do the dishes for my roommates. It's like, okay, are you really going to, like, lay your life down for someone else if you can't do it in that very small way, right? The reality is most, if not all of us, are going to be never going to be finding ourselves in, like, these types of situations, right? Which is why I think it's, like, really safe for us to say that we would die for Jesus in these moments. Because what's really risky is saying that every single day, or considering the fact that every single day, we are presented with opportunities to die for ourselves for the sake of others. Die to ourselves for the sake of others, right? So let me give you some examples of what this looks like. It might be buying a meal for someone else, and you don't have as much money to go out and eat out later in the week, right? You have given up something for yourself for the sake of someone else. It may be raising a child, being patient with them as they learn how the world works, knowing that I am giving up parts of what I used to be able to do or parts of my life so that they may be able to learn from me. It may be not complaining that you did it last week when your spouse asks if you can do the dishes, right? There are so many ways in which we are presented every single day with a way in which we can die to ourselves. We can lay down our life for the sake of others. And let me clarify here, I am not talking about, like, staying in abusive relationships or being in scenarios in which you are, like, constantly being taken advantage of. I'm not asking us to be, like, doormats to enable people's abuse, right? That is far from what Paul means, and that is far from what I mean. That is not what I'm asking you to do. If you're in that situation, or if you're in those scenarios, please, like, talk to your community, talk to us. We will help you get out of that scenario. That is not dying to yourself. That is enabling, I almost did victim abuse, but, like, we don't want to continue to enable abusers, right? What this looks like, though, is, like, if someone is struggling and there's a care portal message and I'm like, well, I'm, like, tight on my budget and I really wanted to go see XYZ movie or I wanted to go to this trip, but, like, maybe I got to buy a dresser, right? That's what it looks like to die to ourselves every single day. And I think every single day we are presented with opportunities to be united to Jesus in his death and resurrection by laying down our lives for the sake of others. Even if it feels like dramatic language for literally letting someone in the lane who sped around and used that bad lane to cut you off, right? But it is laying down our lives for the sake of others. And I think I have not, maybe if we can mute the stream on this part. You can keep recording though, Ed. I don't think I've like really considered this as deeply as I had until we became foster parents to Alex. And so early in my Christian life, like I said, I was sort of captivated by this idea of laying my life down for others. I was just like really into this idea, motivated by this idea of using my giftings, not as a benefit to myself, but to lift others up. And even though I was motivated by the idea, I am really bad at it, right? But when Eric and Blessing walked into our church with two little ones, most of you don't know them, 1 week, and we asked who these grown children were, we knew Blessing did not give birth to a 7-year-old, right? They brought us in on the fact that they were fostering and the goal of foster care being reunification with the birth family and how they were utilizing their house, utilizing their resource, utilizing their well-adjustedness to come alongside a family and lift them up. I was like, man, that is a picture of what Paul is talking about. That is a picture of laying down our lives. And so Jamie and I were captured by this idea of foster care being a manifestation of laying down our life for others. And so we entered foster care. And man, most of you know this, like, it has been a beautiful process of welcoming our son Alex into our lives. He's lived with us for 5 years. Adoption happened 2.5 years ago. It's been really beautiful. It has been harder than I ever realized it would be. It, like, death hurts, you know? I get, like, why Mickey was dreading dying every single day, because there are moments where I'm just, like, dreading a moment where I know it's going to be a really hard conversation for this kid that I love so much. And I am just like, man, like, I don't get what it looks like to, like, find joy in this, because suffering sucks, right? And so when I am inviting us into this, I do not want to do this with, like, caution, throwing caution to the wind. Like, it's hard. It's really difficult to lay our lives down for others. You have this picture, and I had this picture of, like, this heroic, like, reaching my hand into the water and saving the person who's on their last gasp, right? When in reality, laying down our lives is fixing doors that were slammed too hard, and then fixing another door that was slammed too hard, and then recognizing that that device that we bought him, and he uses a ton, cost us a lot of money for him to, like, throw it down the stairs and smash, right? Dying to ourselves is not this, like, often beautiful picture of getting a medal and as everyone claps for how good of a foster parent you are, right? It's like literally cleaning up urine that's thrown at us. It's just like, it's hard. And there are times where I've just like, God, I don't know how I can do this. I don't know how I can continue this, right? I just want to run. And there have been moments where Jamie has had the same thing. But they have also been the moments where I have honestly just like felt the closest to Jesus I have ever felt. I'm just like, Jesus, I know what you felt like in the Garden of Gethsemane when you were like, is there any other way, God? And like, he was bleeding blood, or he was like sweating blood, so his was harder, right? But in my like maybe self-centered idea, I'm just like, man, I'm just like Jesus. But the reality is like in this difficulty, in the raising up of others, I've never felt closer to Jesus than I have now, right? In my cruciformity with him. And I should say this, like, I want to be clear, I'm not a hero. Like, I mess up a ton, but the reality is we have to consider that it is hard, but that we have also been called to take up our cross, right? And I think I want to end with this picture. I was talking about Juneteenth earlier, And I think my favorite part of the story, we watched Juneteenth documentary, some of us did together. And my favorite part was them talking about the black soldiers who show up to Galveston in their full uniform. And these folks who were enslaved, getting almost like a picture of what it could look like. Getting a picture of the dignity that they have always had in these freed soldiers, right? And I think about this idea of these soldiers, some of them being those who were freed from slavery, coming to tell others that they have been invited into the same life. That a proclamation happened for them 2.5 years ago, for us 2,000 years ago, that we no longer have to be in our chains, that we no longer have to be enslaved to our success-driven culture, that we no longer have to be enslaved to the standards of beauty or from crushing despair when it seems like the bad parts of empire are going to win out in the end, right? That we don't have to be enslaved to these sort of ideas anymore. But we are invited, just like the black soldiers, we are invited to go to those who maybe are in slavery themselves and invite them, say, hey, 2,000 years ago, there was a proclamation that happened about your emancipation. You no longer have to be in those chains. You no longer have to succumb to these sort of cultural ideas of where life comes from, right? And it's in that going, it's in that potential suffering, the potential hardness of laying down our life for others, of death working in us, that we might see life in others. That's a picture we have been invited to. And it's messy. It is not always pretty. It's often very much not pretty, usually, right? But the reality is cruciformity with Jesus, getting to be like him not only in his life, but in his death and eventually in his resurrection, is a beautiful, beautiful picture of our God who laid down his life for us. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Missio Dei Uptown podcast. We are a church committed to our neighborhood, seeking to love and serve our beautifully unique community as we join God as he makes all things new. To learn more about us, visit mduptown.com.